The following talk is freely offered. If you'd like to learn more about the Sydney Zen Centre or to make a donation, please visit our website at szc.org.au.
So today I'd like to talk about silent illumination practice. And one of the reasons why I chose this topic today is because there's really some, at times, some misunderstanding and certainly not clear instructions either given about silent illumination practice here. So I wish to address some of that today. Can you sit just a little bit further down, Yvonne? So I'd just like to kind of have everyone in my field of vision. Just like to see you clearly. Thank you. So there are two primary practices in our Soto Rinzai Zen tradition. One is called silent illumination practice and has its associations with Shikan Taza in Japanese Soto Zen. Or as Shikan Taza is known as just sitting. So this is one of our primary practices. And of course the other primary practice is koan practice from the Rinzai tradition. So we're a Soto Rinzai, we hold both these practices and both are celebrated and honoured and respected here. Shikan Taza, she means just, and kan is related to a pipe, a tube, actually, like a pipe, like a wind instrument. And ta means strike. So you put that together and it means like wholeheartedly strike the cushion, like a tube, like a wind tube, like this instrument, this body and mind, wholeheartedly strike the cushion. That's actually what it means, translates literally as. And of course, there's no difference between, essentially, there is no difference between silent illumination practice, and we've referred it as silent illumination practice because that's has its deep roots in China. There's no difference between that and koan practice, essentially. There are different pathways of practice, and essentially, though, it is there's no difference between they're just different gateless gates into the one realization of mind. Silent illumination practice was developed and refined under Master Hong Zhi from the Kaodong, a school of Zen. Kaodong is Soto, who lived in the Song Dynasty back in 960 to 1127. Master Hong Zhi also studied in the Rinzai school, the Lin Chi school, and studied koans under Master Da Hui. Hong Zhi compiled the Book of Serenity, which includes 100 koans, which is essentially a Soto text. And he was responsible for the revival of the Kaodong school, Soto school of Zen. And then this beautiful book that those of you who are interested in silent illumination practice, is an absolutely fabulous book called Cultivating the Empty Field by interesting monk, writer, teacher, Leighton. And it's called The Silent Illumination of Zen Master Hong Zhi. And beautiful, beautiful poetry, just gorgeous kind of descriptions of practice here. So I'm going to take that up today. In the Song Dynasty in China, there was no sectarian divide between koan practice and silent illumination practice. Teachers were conversant in both practices. In fact, Master Hong Zhi's pithy comments on a collection of koans are preserved in the Book of Serenity. And the two great practices are really alive here and honoured here today and come together in our tradition. even though they were in some ways split off and specialized and separate for maybe 1,000 years, they have come back together here in our Diamond Sangha Zen tradition. So I think that that's really special, that we have those practices here. Of course, the one difference that exists in our tradition is that those who take up silent illumination practice as a pathway to the realization of mind cannot be teachers in our tradition. And that's where some of the kind of ideas that the silent illumination practice is some ways inferior, when in fact it's not. It's simply that you cannot teach in our tradition, but simply if you haven't done koans, if you haven't studied koans, you can't teach them. So in that way, it is, some people then think of that there's more privileged, the koans have been more privileged in our tradition, and it's only more privileged in that respect. But essentially, it is the same awakened heart-mind that we are interested in here, no matter which gateway you come through. Philosophically speaking, silent illumination is not a method. It's not a technique of practice. It is actually the state of awakening to our true nature, the freedom that belongs to each and every one of you. As Rinzai said, it's the true person of no rank. Yeah. It is only due to our habitual attachments to dualistic thinking and self-referential feelings that this intrinsic awakened state is temporarily obscured, as the Buddha said on his realization under the Bodhi tree, that all beings by nature are Buddha. It is only our greed, hatred, and delusion that keep us from realizing this very fact. So our true nature has nothing to do with gaining or losing, or having not. It is not more superior or less than. And so, and as Yunmen mentioned in his instructions on working with the Koan Mu, with a bit of has or has not, body is lost, mind is lost, into the world of duality. So we need to make a distinction here between silent illumination as the direct realization of mind and silent illumination that entails practical dimensions with instructions about practice. And I think one of the failings that in the Diamond Sangha tradition has been is that we have given very few instructions in Shikantaza. And Eiken Roshi admitted this, as when his instructions in Shikantaza or silent illumination practice, he would just say, just sit and let go. That's all he would say. And in some ways, for a very experienced, if you like, or strong, dedicated sitters, that was enough. But for many beginners, and also even long-term practitioners, it didn't really lay out the field. And there was no sort of hooks and crevices or things to hang on to. It was like facing the bare cliff. And so, you know, we have been thinking about a lot of how to give further instructions in silent illumination practice. So I think that's one of the failings of our tradition, that we have, particularly for myself, in many Diamond Sangha teachers' meetings over many years now, have put silent illumination front and centre in our meetings and our discussions in how to really support and guide students in this practice. So practice must be in accordance with the correct view that we lack nothing, that we are originally free. And the practice of silent illumination has its roots in Shikantaza, and it has its roots in Shamatha Vipassana, which is related to the Theravadan tradition of Buddhism. Or the Pali scriptures call it Shamatha Vipassana. Shamatha means calmness, vipassana means insight into one's essential nature. So basically we need to establish calming the mind first as a foundation, that once the mind has had a calm, steady base, then insight naturally arises out of that base. So also, just to clarify, that silent illumination practice is not mindfulness. A lot of people think that when they're doing shikantaza, silent illumination, that it's all about mindfulness practice. Well, no, it's not. That is just a kind of stepping stone. Even in the Vipassana tradition, the four foundations of mindfulness are simply stepping stones into choiceless moment-to-moment awareness of just sitting. They are guiding the person into what it means to just sit. Fully open, all-inclusive awareness and a steadiness and groundedness of mind. And that's not easy. Yeah. So it's not mindfulness practice. And also another idea that seems to have crept in over the years here, that in some ways that those who are taking up shikantaza practice don't need a relationship with a teacher. This is not true. And it's important that, you know, whether you're doing shikantaza practice or koan practice, that there is an ongoing refinement and deepening and a dialogue and a conversation that's possible, that we journey together on the path here. We support each other in that deepening and refinement. And there's no end to that refining and deepening of our understanding. So the teacher-student relationship is not just related to koans, koan practice, right? Koan study. Well, this is what we do. This is our life. Where the Zendo is, it sits right in the middle of suburbia, right in the middle of our lives, and this is our practice too, isn't it? I'll take you home. Well, I'll take you home in a different way, folks. Come back to your true home here, all right? I won't punish you, I promise. So where was I? So traditionally in the Theravadan and Tibetan schools, this practice is taught sequentially, shamatha, vipassana, calmness, and then insight. In the Zen tradition, they are taught simultaneously. Calmness and insight go hand in hand and arise together, which is why it's referred to, one of the reasons why we're referred to as the sudden school of awakening. Gao Gu, who also wrote a very interesting article, who is a Zen master in the Silent Illumination School. He's also a Buddhist scholar, has a PhD in Buddhist studies, and he wrote a very interesting article on Silent Illumination practice and its similarities with Shamatha Vipassana. He said that in silence there is illumination, in stillness clarity is ever present. And so the image that he uses is like a flame flickering in a room. Yeah? If the flame is flickering and unsteady, then the light is unclear. But when the image and when the flame of the candle is steady, and the light of the mind is steady and clear, then clarity and wisdom naturally arise out of that. In reality, the silent illumination of Master Hongzhi, or Dogen Shikantaza, does not fall into stages and categories. In silent illumination practice, if we think of stages, it breeds expectation that there will be an experience of discrete, separate stages. So it's very difficult to talk about silent illumination practice, but actually I'm going to talk about it in stages, just as I've said that. And I'd like you to keep in mind that there are no discrete stages and categories in practice, but to more think about it as a process of unfolding, of refining, of deepening, of understanding. So forgive me for mentioning stages as a kind of very problematic in Zen, but I'm actually going to talk about stages. Hold the stages lightly, please. Yeah. So these stages are associated with deepening into samadhi, the baseline of calmness, concentration, of practice. So we move from the stages, generally speaking, from scattered mind to concentrated, focused mind, to unified mind, to the mirror mind of samadhi, to the realization of no mind. And they are distinct, actually, sort of insights that arise from each of these places, yeah? Which I'll sort of unpack a little bit if I can. There's a quote from Master Hongzhi about silent illumination, which I think is a beautiful quote that really describes silent illumination practice. The correct way of practice is to simply sit in stillness and silently investigate. Deep down, there is a state one reaches where externally one is no longer swirled about by causes and conditions. The mind being empty, it is all-embracing. Its luminosity being wondrous, it is precisely present and impartial. Internally, there are no thoughts of grasping after things, vast and removed, being just as it is, free from confusion and delusion, alive and potent, all dependency and opposition are severed. One remains self-contained. So, beautiful sense of depth in there, isn't it? Yeah. This is kind of the orientating our compass in practice, is trying to deepen into that mind beyond the swirl of causes and conditions. So the first stage here is entered through just sitting in a relaxed body. And it's very important to learn to relax, really learn to relax in an upright, alive, present moment. When I studied a little while ago, I went and did a retreat, 10-day retreat in New Zealand with an interesting Burmese teacher, Tejaniya. And the first 3 days of the retreat, all he said, the only instructions he gave was, relax, relax, relax. It's like, okay. He just thought Westerners were so uptight, so tense, and we bring so much stuff from our daily lives. And, you know, and there was teachers, other teachers and abbots of monasteries who flew from all over the world to kind of do this retreat. So there was largely a lot of teachers on this retreat. And the same instructions were given. Relax. Okay. So one maintains awareness of the whole body breath sitting here. And this first stage is we focus in on the breath, and it's a very narrow focus, if you like, of just being with the rise and fall of the breath and the experience of the breath in the body, counting the breath. And then there is the instructions to actually widen one's awareness to what's called the whole body breath, all one word. So it goes like this. It's like the awareness then moves into the whole body, as if from the head to the toe you are experiencing a steadiness of mind with the whole body as there is breathing. It's like the breath moves to the edges of the skin, the subtlety of the breath. So there's an experience of expansion to the whole body breathing and just sitting there. When the mind gets very steady with that, the next step in the concentration aspect of the practice is to let go body. So the body is no longer then a burden. The acute sensations fade into the background, and even when bodily sensations are present, you are not really disturbed by them. The mind's calmness and presence takes precedence, and in the background is the kind of awareness of body. So first of all, body is in foreground of consciousness, the breath is in foreground, sensations of the breath are in foreground, and then it gradually, as the awareness increases and the depth of concentration increases, the sensations of body kind of fade into the background. There may be even quite a lot of pain sometimes in the body, but it's not so disturbing. That's what that means. It's the first stage of concentrated mind. Most of the time, however, most students, we find it difficult to get to that concentrated state of mind, particularly coming here in Zazen, you know, on a weeknight. It's very difficult to get into those deep samadhi states. Most of the time we're struggling with all manner of stories and thoughts and kind of trying to deal with what happened at work and painful emotions that come up in our family and our relationships, and you know, we're kind of managing, soothing kind of all of that stuff, dealing with the old kind of pains and woundedness or anxiety or fears and doubts. I mean, what we're dealing most of the time in trying to get a kind of still place and awareness, most of the time that's what students kind of are working with, yeah? What's present in the mind. It's hard to get past three breaths before the mind just launches itself somewhere into some story, and God knows where's that, you know, after 10 minutes you kind of go, oh, I've been thinking about, worrying about blah blah, need to come back to the breath, you know? Is that familiar? For most of us, that's kind of what our daily practice is like, yeah? Caught up in a lot of kind of papancha. The Buddha had this beautiful word for stories of I, me, my stories and all our kind of dramas and self-opera that goes on inside. He called it papancha. One word. Mental and emotional afflictions of mind. The TV, 24 different TV channel in your mind is called papancha. I love that. It's great. One single word for that state of mind. Mm. So, deepening into samadhi, and the first stage of practice is deepening into silence. And this is the aspect of silent illumination which is has a powerful kind of teaching in itself, just this silence. Yeah? To really deepen into silence is to kind of not only have the body still and silent in some ways, yeah? But it's also to deepen the stories in the mind, yeah? To in some sense drop below the stories of the mind so that there is a quiet, calm, peaceful, serene place of awareness, yeah? And that silence is absolutely precious. Ramana Maharshi Mahesh Yogi was one of the great Hindu teachers, and I loved his teachings. Vedanta teacher in South India, great realized soul. And he spoke highly of silence. And he said some lovely things about silence. He said, silence is the greatest thief. Steals away all your ideas and concepts and knowledge and thoughts, yeah, in the mind. He said, silence is the loudest form of prayer. And silence is the highest form of grace. And he means by that is that when the mind is silent and the self is silent, the stories around self, yeah, when there's a dropping away of that mind, yeah, then there's a mystical silence, a wordless silence in our heart that transcends speech and silence. Yeah. So the second stage, yeah, of kind of practice, think process, not stage, even though I'm saying stage, sorry. I don't know how else to articulate it in a way. It's a kind of the problem with language, isn't it, and ideas and words. So second stage is called unified mind. What does this mean? It's body, mind and environment become one. Internally and externally are united. You perceive your immediate surroundings as your great body. The floor, the window, the bird songs, the voices outside, the crickets, each person sitting here, the particulars of our experience. Yeah, this is the great body sitting here. When we open that mind beyond the kind of limitations of this personal body, we open the mind to that world of interconnectedness. So the insight that arises is the oneness. Yeah? With each step in practice, there's an insight, there's an illumination of mind. And that experience of oneness and interconnectedness that opens us up into that sort of sense of formlessness. Yeah? That you are everything. Yeah? And everything is you. That is the world of oneness. But it's not the whole truth, it's an insight that's along the path. Yeah? We even need to go beyond oneness. But it's certainly an important experience, and it breaks open the small notions of the self-identity. Yeah? The next stage, third stage in practice, is called mirror mind of samadhi. And there's many, many references in the text to the mirror mind of samadhi. And this is where the mind is like a mirror, just reflecting bare awareness, like any mirror. We walk into the bathroom, we look at ourselves in the mirror every day, right? The mirror doesn't say, I don't want to look at you right now. I don't want to reflect back you. The mirror just is clear, open, receptive, reflects back whatever is in front of it, just as it is. Yeah? And the same... that same analogy is true of our minds. When there is a steadiness and clear, calm presence, the mind is concentrated, focused and present, then it's like a mirror. It reflects back things just as they are. This is... And there is only presence of the whole environment here. The distinction between inside and outside falls away in that distinction, you know, in that understanding, yeah? When the mind is just very clear and open. Thoughts come and go. They are like the surface of the waves on the ocean, but the ocean in itself is deep and undisturbed. And so the silent aspect of the practice is that it's peaceful. When there's a mirror mind, a samadhi, it's very peaceful and still and equanimous. And the virtue that comes out of that mirror mind of samadhi is equanimity. And equanimity is not being thrown around by pleasant and unpleasant, painful, difficult, gain and loss. There's a sense of being able to be equanimous and balanced and steady in amongst the adversities of daily life. It's a beautiful state of mind. And the illumination in the mirror mind of samadhi, or the insight that arises, is that it's free also of clinging and aversion. The mirror is just reflecting things as they are. So when it's free of clinging and aversion, when we have that set of steadiness of mind, it's free of attachments, It's free of having or having not experiences. And in that freedom, it is a deepening into contentment. The virtue that comes is contentment and peace, a greater sense of peace, because there's not grasping after life. Freedom from grasping. In stage four, it is a mind of boundless space. The sense of vastness permeates both internally and externally in the environment. The metaphor here is the empty space in the room and furniture. This is the one way of describing that spaciousness of mind. The space in the room, in this room, is not affected by whether the cushions are clean or dirty, although we definitely prefer to have clean cushions. But the space essentially is not affected by the furniture or the objects in the room. We can take all the objects out of the room and there's still the space, right? And this space can have all manner of objects in this room. In the history of this room, there's been all manner of, like, how many people have sat in this dojo in this space? So the spaciousness of mind is not affected by the content, the furniture, the cushions, or whatever's happening in the room. In other words, the original spaciousness of the room allows the accommodation of all things, all forms. Similarly, in the midst of vexations or emotional afflictions, the true nature of mind is and has always been empty and free of disturbance. The problem is, most of the time, we are orientated to the content in the room, right? We're not orientated always to the spaciousness of our mind. We're focused on objects, people, and things, largely, in our life. So, sitting in that spaciousness opens up a whole kind of another dimension to who we are. Gao Gu says in that moment, passing thoughts and emotions arise and cease. They liberate themselves moment after moment. We don't have to liberate our thoughts and get rid of them, and nor our emotions. They come and go, because we are that spacious room. We are that spacious container. The flow of life happens through us, moment by moment. It never stops flowing. I'd like to tell us a dream here too. And so, it's a dream I had last year at when I was teaching a retreat at Samsuria in Byron Bay. And I woke up in the middle of the night and I just had, I had various Dharma books by my bedside, and I just picked up the first book, and because it was in the middle of the night, it was sort of I was awake. And I was reading Ramana Maharshi's Awakening Experience, which I've read before. He was a self-realized saint and he had a profound experience through contemplation of death, actually. And in that description, there was one word, one line that sort of leaped out at me. And it was like, when he realized, I am not the body. And so I then went back to sleep with this line reverberating through my mind. And then I had this dream. And the dream was that I was in with a group of people. It was family and friends and loved ones and a whole group of people there. And I was very focused on my relationships and connections with all this group of people. And so I was very attached, if you like, to the sort of body and mind, the form of other, and related them to them in that kind of, through the form. And then all of a sudden, it's like this words came through my mind, I am not the body, sort of landed in the middle of my dream. And it's like, at that moment, I just turned around very, very slowly and looked behind me. And what opened up was this kind of vast universe of spacious, empty, vast universe. And I suddenly thought, oh my God, I've been looking in the wrong direction all this time. And it wasn't as if I was denying the kind of forms and the bodily kind of mind-body experience that we all inhabit. But it was a different orientation. And I still felt sort of in love with the divine and, you know. And so I remember waking up to the early morning bell through the forest. And I woke up feeling this incredible sense of contentment and peace. And it never left me since that time. So it's like the emptiness and the form is like there was some attachment to the form of other in some ways. It's like it's one thing to have an insight into the emptiness of this body and mind here, but can we see also into the emptiness of other? Anyway, offer that as a kind of interesting experience. It's always, of course, important to actualize the dream rather than it just remaining a dream. So the last stage in practice is that emptiness has a function, has a natural function. When we see into that emptiness and we can take refuge in that empty nature, in our own vast and empty nature, spacious nature, it opens us to that dynamic ability to change, to accommodate, to liberate ourselves each moment. Silent illumination is only a metaphor, you know, for this inseparability of the empty nature and its function and its relationship to emptiness and form. And with this wisdom, we can respond to one another without fixations, you know, without self-importance, without rigidity, without self-referencing all the time that everything that happens, we often self-reference it back to me, back to oneself, or everything being about ourselves. So we can actually rest and take refuge in this vastness of our nature without grasping, without the self-grasping, which is the underlying cause that the Buddha spoke about that causes suffering. So then it becomes a natural responsiveness, you know, like a reflection in a mirror. Just deal with what is each moment. Yeah. So as the third patriarch conveyed in his poem, Faith in Mind, the great way is not difficult, it simply avoids picking and choosing. So when there is that freedom from grasping and aversion, or reaching out after other, or avoiding and dismissing, mind rests in its own clear awareness. Releasing all grasping then brings about that clarity of mind. So when we sit, we do not try to get rid of anything. We don't need to rearrange the furniture in the room. Awareness is non-abiding. So be mindful, don't allow the mind to fixate on anything there. Don't even cling to the silence, nor the stillness, or even clarity of mind, or objects of meditation. The wisdom component is that we see all things as impermanent. All things have no abiding self-nature. All things are intimately connected. And with this realization, we can celebrate ourselves and life joyously. And that is the expression of, the deep expression of silent illumination. So So let's rejoice in that as our primary practice. Thank you.
This talk has been freely offered. If you'd like to learn more about Sydney Zen Centre activities or to make a donation, please visit www.szc.org.au. Thank you for listening.